39. It is cloudy. It is 39 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha right now. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. You're about to be taken on an absolutely harrowing journey into the heart of the Arctic, and an absolutely true and extraordinary story told in a book called Empire of Ice and Stone, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Kalaalleq. This is an event which occurred back in the summer of 1913 when an ill-fated expedition was taken to the Arctic. And those who undertook this journey, particularly those who were aboard this ship called the Kalaalleq, found themselves very quickly and unexpectedly ice-bound. And it was potentially disastrous situation, and it was really only the heroic efforts of some of the people involved in this, and in particular Captain Bob Bartlett, that at least some of them managed to survive this this catastrophe. The story is one of what it means to be a real leader, and it also is a story about, in a sense, foolishness. In terms of undertaking such challenging journeys without proper understanding or preparation. So a cautionary tale on many, many different levels. The book is written by someone who knows a lot about the Arctic. His name is Buddy Levy, and perhaps you have heard of his extraordinary book called Labyrinth of Ice, The Triumphant and Tragic Greely Polar Expedition. He's written a number of other books as well, including a co-author of No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon, and Geronimo, Leadership Strategies of an American Warrior. This book, again, is called Empire of Ice and Stone, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Kalaalleq, published by St. Martin's Press. Buddy Levy, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's an honor to be here. I really appreciate it. And I love your setup. It really speaks to some of the drama, heroism, and folly that are involved in this tale.
Absolutely. It's an incredible story. And I have to say, too, this is probably the third or fourth interview I have done over the course of, well, I've been doing this for about a quarter century. And this is by no means the first time we've talked on the Morning Show about some kind of disaster in the polar region of the planet. But it really underscores for me how each of these stories is distinct. And this one, in many respects, is as fascinating as any. But is kind of remarkable is that, if I understand correctly, even though you have had a great interest in the Arctic and Arctic exploration for quite some time, this was a story that you kind of stumbled upon and really didn't know very much about. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, that's true. And you mentioned my other book, Labyrinth of Ice, an Arctic disaster narrative. But just a little background. I had grown up in a very cold and wintry place in Idaho, and my father was a Nordic ski champion and an Olympian, and he kind of initially started telling me about the he had traveled in Scandinavia when he was competing in skiing, and he started telling me about Arctic exploration when I was probably a teen. But Really, I came across the stories about Fridtjof Nansen and Amundsen and other Norwegian Arctic explorers on a trip to Greenland in 2003. And that was when I started working on Labyrinth of Ice. And during the research for Labyrinth of Ice, I came across some references to this story of the Karluk and the Canadian Arctic expedition. But I just sort of filed those away and thought, well, that's interesting. And then after Labyrinth came out, I went back and revisited those files, and I started reading more deeply about Stephenson and Bartlett and this amazing story. And the more I read, the more I became enthralled and just riveted by particularly the one-year period, 1913 to 14, in which the Karluk just undergoes this remarkable ordeal.
Hmm. In the last portion of the book, when you are kind of explaining where you got your information, you talk about how this story, which you found to be an enthralling epic survival and rescue narrative, what was so distinctive about this was that there were two men at the heart of the story, very different from each other. I've already mentioned Captain Robert Bartlett, who in so many respects is the hero of this story, who works tirelessly and with great innovation to try and keep his party alive against nearly insurmountable odds. Set against him is the man for whom this whole expedition, it was his brainchild, one Vilhelmur Stefansson, who we could probably call the villain of the story. Tell us more, without getting into too many specifics yet, but just a little bit about how these two men and their presence in this story made it, in a sense, especially compelling for you and a story you really wanted to tell.
Right, yeah. So it's interesting, you know, Robert Bartlett was from Brigus, Newfoundland, and he came from a really distinctive and venerated mariner family, generations of sealers and whalers and cod fishermen from Newfoundland. And he became really known because Robert Peary took him in this ship, the Roosevelt, as captain and ice master on a number of his Peary's North Pole voyages attempts. And in fact, Bartlett was there as the leader of what was the pioneer party on Peary's attempt, that for which he claimed to have found the North Pole. And Bartlett, after they left the Roosevelt at the top of Ellesmere Island and struck out with dog sled teams over the ice, Bartlett in fact made it all the way to within 150 miles of the North Pole, at which point Robert Peary told him to turn back to the Roosevelt, and he was going to take Matthew Henson instead. And it was an amazing moment in Bartlett's life, because he was maybe a day or two from polar immortality, but he was a dutiful captain, and he was asked to turn back to the Roosevelt, so he did. Later, when Vilhelmur Stefansson is in 1912 is conspiring to put this Canadian Arctic expedition together, he ends up in Europe at a conference, at a polar conference, and he runs into Peary, and Peary suggests that Robert Bartlett is the world's greatest living ice navigator. And so Stephenson sends Bartlett a telegram and says, will you join me on the Karluk? And within weeks, Bartlett has met Stephenson in Esquimalt, British Columbia, and they're about to board the Karluk, and it's all happening very quickly.
One of the main stories of this is the ill-preparedness of this expedition. The fact that Stephenson had put this together, one gets a sense with glory in mind, but with a bit of carelessness when it came to preparations for this journey. And one of the chief points of contention is this ship itself, the Karluk, and whether or not it was a good choice for such an expedition. Tell us more about this converted whaler and why Robert Bartlett, among others, was concerned about it being chosen as one of the vehicles for this expedition.
Right. So, as you mentioned, you know, Stephenson, he put this expedition together in a matter of maybe 6 months, and which is not enough time for an expedition of the magnitude that involves, you know, a three-ship armada, 16 international scientists, and other crew, you know, another dozen crew members. So he has purchased this ship called the Karluk, which is a 27-ton, 129-foot American-built steam brigantine, which had 3 decades of service in the salmon fishing industry. The problem is that it had like 150-horsepower steam engine, and the chief engineer of the ship, Don Monroe, remarked before they were about to set out, it had about as much power as an old coffee pot. And they're about to embark on, you know, there's a great understanding that they're going to be confronting Arctic sea ice and floes. And so it was not really retrofitted for ice travel. And Bartlett was concerned at the very beginning and, in fact, had further sheathing and work done on the engine in Alaska before they finally set off. But, you know, Bartlett had, as I mentioned, he'd been the captain of a 1,000-horsepower iron-hulled vessel called the Roosevelt. And so, you know, this ship was undergunned by his standards. Now, the other thing is that there were two other ships involved, the Alaska and the Mary Sachs. And so at the beginning, you mentioned the unpreparedness. One of the things that was really striking to me is that the plan was to take all these ships from once they gathered in Port Barrow and after Nome, they were going to sail east over to a place called Herschel Island and then convene there and reorganize everything. And so part of the problem was that Stephenson didn't have all of the right equipment and all of the right men on the right ships. And there was no real contingency plan for what ultimately happened, which was that the ships got separated, and after which point the wrong men and the wrong gear were on the wrong ships.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Buddy Levy, and we're talking about his latest book, which is called Empire of Ice and Stone, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Karluk. This is the story of an ill-fated Arctic expedition in the summer of 1913, and it primarily focuses on the misfortune of those aboard the converted whaler, the Karluk, which gets stranded in the ice and faces enormous and nearly insurmountable peril. Let's step back for a moment and talk a little bit more about what prompted this particular expedition to the Arctic, and maybe you could lay it in some historic context, since you know so much about polar exploration and its history. When we get to the summer of 1913, how much exploration of the polar region has occurred, and how does this particular expedition fold into that? In what ways was this as unprecedented an expedition as Mr. Johansson, Stephenson, build it?
Right. That's a really great question. So, as I mentioned, Peary had claimed the pole in 1909. And so most or many Arctic expeditions prior to this point had been engaged in exploration and attempts at firsts. You know, they were trying to find in the mid 19th century, they were trying to find their way through the Northwest and Northeast passages, right, with Franklin's expeditions. And many, many attempts were being made on, trying to find the North Pole. Prior to that, there were all of these expeditions that were geared toward farthest north, because no one had made it to the pole. So there was this great unknown. And these were all, in my mind, geared around, you know, being first, the first to reach some point in the great north regions, which were vast, you know. And so once Peary claimed the pole, and I say claimed because there's quite a bit of controversy around whether or not he actually made it to the North Pole. And as a slight sidebar, I wanted to mention, because of the importance of Robert Bartlett in this tale, that on that expedition in 1909, in which Peary sent Bartlett back, that turned out to be one of the great mistakes that he made, because Bartlett, as I said, was the world's greatest living ice master and navigator, and he was expert with a sextant and taking readings. And so by Bartlett sending him back, there became a subsequent decades of controversy around whether Peary's readings were correct and whether Peary actually made it to the North Pole. And if had he taken Bob Bartlett, I'm quite confident that those doubts would have been assuaged. So when Stephenson returns from 4 years of another expedition, and he had been on another expedition doing exploration around the Coronation Gulf region above northern Canada and in Alaska, and living among the Inupiat and Inuit people, he shifted gears. And so when he arrived back in Seattle, he had this tale of having confronted and lived among and met what he was calling blonde Eskimos. And the premise was that these Eskimos, or they were using the term Eskimos in that time, was that these were descendants of the Viking Eric the Red, who had landed in Greenland, and then these were ancestors, or descendants. And the news media, New York Times and other global outlets, really took to this story. Now, Stephenson kind of ran with it and used that as a marketing tool to put together the 1913 Canadian Arctic Expedition. And even though he wasn't the one who first came up with this, he had heard about it from some other sources. But at that point, I guess the main difference, so things were shifting from exploration and expeditions to be first and to sort of conquer and achieve great notoriety from having gone where no one else had gone before, to being more primarily a scientific expedition. And that, I guess, is the primary shift that began to happen around this time.
Right. And as you tell us about this story of the so-called blonde Eskimos that Stephenson shared, and the public really became enraptured with it, you tell us Stephenson would allow the story to resonate and grow, and meanwhile he would use it to help bolster a grand and ambitious new plan to return to the Arctic as soon as possible with the largest contingent of scientists ever assembled on a polar voyage. You also tell us that Stephenson, because he had some background in debate, that he had a knack for persuasion, and one of the things he managed to do was to persuade one Robert Bartlett to serve as captain of the Karluk, despite Bartlett's concerns about the ship and whether or not it was fit for such an arduous journey. You also tell us that Robert Bartlett had serious concerns or misgivings when it came to the crew, which he himself did not assemble. Tell us a little more about that. I mean, about the significance of how a captain would want to select their own crew, and the kind of crew which Robert Bartlett, in fact, had at his disposal on this occasion.
Right. So, Bartlett arrived very quickly to Esquimalt, and there was already a crew assembled, but and that captain, whose name is escaping me at the moment, there was already a crew assembled, but that captain had also had misgivings about the ship, and so he begged off at the last minute, and then...
Oh, yes, Theodore Peterson. I just found his name.
Yeah, yes. Theodore Peterson, thank you. You know, who had been a crony of Stefansson's, and so... But he didn't like the look of the ship either, and so he took another job and left. And then Stefansson contacted Bartlett. The crew, you know, also it was getting to be sort of late in the season, so you sort of, you know, you get what you are given. And so Bartlett would have taken much more care if he had had months in advance to pick all of these crew members. And you know, you're talking about, you know, chief engineers and first mates and firemen, the people who stoked the steam boilers and a cook. And there were some real problems. You know, Bartlett discovered on arrival that there were some rumors that the cook, Robert Templeman, was a drug addict and addicted to opium. And, you know, there was just some, many of them were really young. They were in their teens. And so, you know, Bartlett had just come back from a kind of poor, cod fishing expedition. And he loved the North so much that I think, you know, he just decided to go for it. And also he wasn't expecting to go on the voyage that the Karlik ended up going on, and we can get into that. You know, the intention was to remain a little closer to the Canadian and Alaskan northern shores and the islands there, but the ship ends up going on a tour, an unintended tour, beyond the capacities of most ships of the day. So... yeah, that was sort of how that all came about.
Right. Of course, one factor beyond all of the human error that we have already talked about in terms of Mr. Stefansson's rush to launch this and his vagueness about what turned out to be crucial details and so on, Mother Nature, of course, played a very significant hand in all of this as well. Explain how distinctive the weather was in this particular summer of 1913 and the kind of problems which that ultimately created for the expedition and specifically for the Karlik.
Right. That is just amazing. You know, so they finally take off by early August as they're making their way around Point Barrow, Alaska, and east toward this Herschel Island. They encounter essentially violent winter storms. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine for a lot of people how quickly the season shifts. You know, it's a very short season that far north. And so they begin to encounter encroaching ice, you know, snowstorms, temperatures nearing zero already in early August. And, you know, there are some quotes about that, you know, weather was kept in these days, and so there are some quotes about it was the earliest winter on historical record in that region. And so coupled with some of the problematic organizational issues, you've got this double whammy, you know, essentially a perfect storm of terrible weather very early, right as they're getting started. I mean, this expedition doesn't get very far in the first place, at least insofar as the Karlik is concerned. Hmm. And so they become iced in some 6 weeks after they start. And while, you know, Bartlett is trying to find open leads in these giant floes that are beginning to surround the ship, they're beginning to become encased, essentially, or as the term is used by mariners of the time, beset or nipped by ice.
Hmm. And that is, of course, where the really catastrophic portion of this story begins. We're talking with Buddy Levy about his book, Empire of Ice and Stone, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Karluk. This is a good point, I think, for us to pause for a moment and to talk about the wealth of material that was available to you in order to tell this story with such remarkable detail. I mean, you're able to tell us on a nearly day-to-day basis about exactly what happened and who did what and so on. And, I mean, it was just, you know, maybe midway through the book, I started to realize this is extraordinary that we know so much about this. And is it your own supposition, or in fact, is there some way that we do know this? And of course, it's only at the very end of the book and find in your author's notes that you, in a sense, spell out for us the kind of written legacy that was that existed for you to explore. Explain that extensive record of what took place on this voyage that allows you to tell this story with such remarkable detail.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this was a windfall that, you know, researchers and writers lived for, essentially. You know, in the day, and I mean, this happened for me in Labyrinth of Ice as well. So there was a tradition of, and especially in scientific-based or military expeditions, there was a tradition of official journals that were to be the possession of the expedition's leaders and or government, and also personal diaries. So a large number of the members of this expedition, and in particular, I will say that there was a Scottish school teacher named William McKinley, and then a Norwegian assistant topographer named Bjarne Mammen, whose diaries are just remarkable in their in how often. I mean, they were writing every single day, and they were writing a great deal. But many other members of the expedition kept diaries and also official journals that. You know, it's mind-boggling that they're carrying these things and scribbling at the end of each day, sometimes after, you know, a 12 to 15 hour trek, and then building an igloo and then taking the time to write detailed records. The other thing that was really beneficial is that because it was initially it was a scientific voyage that became you know, a voyage of survival, essentially. But they had scientific equipment, so they were able to record wind speeds and temperatures throughout the ordeal. And so I was really lucky because these materials are housed all over the world, National Archives, the National Library of Scotland, Dartmouth Library, Bowdoin Library, and so really well-kept diaries by multiple members, which also gave me the and I would add that what's really great about these diaries, so there's the official journals, which, you know, don't elaborate much on, you know, sort of personal elements, and then there are the diaries, and in the diaries the members will, you know, talk about other members and talk about and give you great insights and details into the kind of, you know, infighting that might be going on, personal conflicts between people, you know, suspicions of mutiny, you know, talking about the fact that one member might be, you know, using strychnine when they're not supposed to be, or taking opium, and also weighing in on the, you know, their own personal fears and misgivings and nightmares, essentially, about what's going to happen to them.
That reminds me of an interesting point which is made at one point in the book, that that Captain Bartlett was not only concerned about kind of the quality of the ragtag crew to which he was essentially assigned, but he also had some concerns about the relationship between the crew members and the scientists. The scientists who were aboard, and the fact that, and this was perhaps not unique to this expedition, but maybe it was especially true, that the relationship between these two groups was not especially positive or even respectful. And this probably made a difficult situation still worse. Can you elaborate on that just a bit?
Sure, sure. And I want to say that, I guess the thumbnail on that is that, you know, when all of the members have boarded the Karlik and they're setting off at the beginning, you've got, you know, a half a dozen scientists, including the expedition leader, Stephenson, and then you've got this ragtag crew. So the scientists are all mostly men of letters. They're educated. Almost, I think, everyone but one had a college degree. And the crew members are, you know, regular, hardworking folk seamen, you know, just. And then what complicated matters was, I think, that Stephenson had the good sense to, at Barrow, to hire on an Inupiat family, a man named Kurluk, his wife, Kiruk, who's nicknamed Auntie, and then their two children, Helen and Mugpi. And so you've also got some embedded racism at the outset, because the crew members, and I would say more the crew members than the scientists at the beginning, are wondering, A, why we've brought on a family of Inupiat people, which, by the way, thank God he did. And then so there was some, you know, under their breath remarks about that, you know, some overt racist remarks. Ironically, it turns out that, you know, Kurluk and his family are responsible probably for saving most of these crew members' lives. But yeah, so there was as they're beginning and then they become beset, there's a lot of tension, misgivings about what's going to happen, because now the ship is sort of drifting in an island square mile of ice. And then you've got this really diverse, not unified group of 25 or so people on the ship. And, you know, there's murmurings and mumblings and a little bit of resentment. And that stuff, I will say, a lot of that gets worked out in its own way as this, sort of unconventional community of people begin to have to live together.
Exactly. You tell us as the Karlik is facing the prospect of becoming frozen in the ice, frozen and stranded in a sense, you mentioned the fact that there were two prevailing philosophies for ice navigation, the Atlantic theory and the Alaska or Beaufort Sea theory. And it's so interesting about this particular choice that would confront somebody undertaking an expedition like this under these conditions. Can you draw the distinction for us between those two theories?
Sure. At this time, you know, I have to say that what a lot of people don't know and don't visualize is that, you know, the sea ice is a moving, almost living thing. And so it's constantly shifting, and giant chunks of ice are being carried by wind and current in different directions. And at the time, as they begin to sense that they're going to be beset, and so the way to maneuver around in this area, unless you have, you know, a steel-hulled icebreaker where you can bash through it, and they did not have one, you have to decide how bold you want to be about heading offshore and searching for open leads, which are, you know, open sections of water through which you can navigate. And so there's some discussion among or between Bartlett and Stephenson about whether they should hug the shore because it's becoming foggy and snowy and the ice is encroaching. Hug the shore in the Beaufort method, or take a bolder course and the Atlantic theory of heading farther offshore and try to find open leads and then weave your way to where you're going. And so they, you know, Stephenson actually agrees, okay, go for it, because they're they're kind of stuck. And so it's, if we're going to get to Herschel Island and then, you know, unpack and resort and reorganize, we need to do something. And it ends up being one of a number of fateful choices, because they head out north even farther into, you know, toward the middle of the Arctic Ocean. But they don't, they're not, they only get 10 or 15 miles offshore, but still that choice ends up being problematic, because they get encased and the other two ships, the Alaska and the Mary Sachs, hug the shore and do not suffer the same fate as the Karluk.
Mm. And of course, that separation is a big deal, a very complicating factor, to say the very, very least. One of the interesting problems that Captain Bartlett faces is that at certain points in time, I mean, you have the Karluk locked, stranded in this ice, and that at certain points it makes sense for the crew to be off the Karluk and actually on this really large expanse of ice in which they are trapped. But then at certain points, that would be unsafe, and they would have to climb aboard the Karluk again for fear that as that ice was maybe starting to crack or break up, that somebody could plunge to their death. And then on the other hand, there were points at time when there was the real danger that the Karluk would be crushed by the ice, and so Captain Bartlett would have to order them to be making preparations for potentially abandoning the ship. And that's one of the most striking things, I think, about this, is this back and forth as Captain Bartlett is trying to stay ahead of this really dangerous situation where he has to decide on a nearly hourly basis, do we stay on the ship or do we get off the ship? I mean, what do we do next? It is an unfolding saga, and he just can't predict the course of events.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things I've always been struck by when you've got, you know, like it's this mile and a half or so square of ice in which the Karluk is drifting. And by the way, once it begins its drift, it's drifting sometimes very fast. But as you say, conditions are variable. So there will be times when it gets really, really cold and enough ice, surrounding ice, knits together around them, they're able to get off the ship. And even, you know, Bjarne Mammen, the Norwegian, is teaching them how to ski, and they have, you know, festivities and sports competitions out on the ice, and they're doing exploratory dog sled work. And then, of course, as you say, the weather will shift and fissures begin to cleave in the ice. And, you know, so then Bartlett starts to understand that we need a system in which sometimes we'll have to unload a whole bunch of gear and coal and food and be prepared for what might happen, and then sometimes bring a bunch of it back up, back on, you know, so they're always prepared. On the top decks, they have a lot of, you know, maybe a year's worth of gear and food and coal, potentially for the potentiality that the Karluk will be crushed. And I must add that there's a looming kind of dread as well, because the direction that they're floating, which is, you know, northwest from Alaska toward Siberia, there were numerous other voyages that went really, really bad and are in the historical record. And they have these logs and books in the Karluk Library, and many of the members are reading about these dreadful fates of, the Captain DeLong's Jeanette. And they know that Fridtjof Nansen, the Norwegian, who took the specially designed Fram 30 years before and intentionally encased it in the ice, had drifted in a very particular direction. So they have a sense of where they're going, and a lot of them are reading this DeLong's logs, which is not really uplifting evening reading when you're heading in that same direction for the same potential fate.
Absolutely. And I do appreciate not only your wonderful way with words, but also the beautiful way in which some who were experiencing this talk about this ice and what it was like to be locked in it, to be encased in it. Part of the crew talks about the seething masses of ice battling for supremacy. Someone else wrote finding the noise at times deafening, at times wondrously musical, describing thunderous rumbles coming from all directions, rending, crashing, tearing noises, grating, screeching, toning down to drumming, booming, murmuring, gurgling, twanging, all the sounds of a gigantic orchestra. He is describing the sounds of the ice against the Karluk. And Captain Bartlett, at one point, writing in his journal, she cracked and groaned and once or twice actually sobbed as the water oozed through her seams, that is, the seams of the Karluk. There is nothing more human than a ship in ice pressure. So in other words, although we might imagine these events unfolding in the icy stillness of the Arctic, in fact, at many points in time, it was anything but still or silent. And it's just hard to imagine living through this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad you note that, because the there's a great juxtaposition between the violent rupturing sound of ice crashing together, you know, and you have to remember that these are immense masses of flows of ice. Think of them as like tectonic plates of ice, sometimes, you know, 10 and 15 miles in circumference and length. And when these kinds of bodies of ice carried at high speeds on Arctic currents crash together, it's tremendously violent, creating, in fact, pressure ridges that they have to deal with, where these plates come together and they upthrust, sometimes up to 100 feet high. But against that, there's also an incredible calm and stillness. There's an incredible calm and stillness sometimes. And I always was enamored by William McKinley's descriptions. He would often go out off the ship a ways, maybe where he could still see it, but in night, and watch the aurora borealis, and then look back at the ship, and he would see the moonlight glinting off of these hummocks and ice boulders and structures that sometimes looked like dinosaurs or bears. And so there's a beauty and a violence to ice that I think a lot of people who haven't been in the far north don't understand. They kind of picture it as being a giant flat ice rink, you know, but it is anything but.
Absolutely.
Anything but.
And for them to have to journey across that was exceedingly dangerous. And, of course, we haven't even touched upon the fact that the leader of all this, Vilhjálmur Stefánsson, ultimately abandons the Karluk with five men and the best dogs in what he says is a caribou hunt, but which you and others ultimately characterize as essentially abandoning ship. And he never does return to the Karluk, and he leaves Captain Bartlett and those remaining to their own devices to somehow survive this horrendous ordeal. I want to return to the fact that part of what drew you to this story was Captain Bartlett versus Vilhjálmur Stefánsson, the drastically different ways in which they were each leaders. And a lot of times when we have a story and there appears to be a hero and a villain, then the closer we look, the more villainous the hero looks and the more heroic the villain looks. In other words, those lines tend to blur. I have a sense, though, with this story, the more you explored it, the more you examined this story and what exactly unfolded, that delineation remains fairly clear. Is it fair to say that?
Yeah, I think you've characterized that right. I mean, listen, Stefánsson, I don't quibble with the fact that he was a remarkable scientist, and he ended up writing, you know, a book called My Life with the Eskimo, and he wrote a book called The Friendly Arctic, which is ironic, but the so what happened was when Stephenson decided to leave the ship, it was coupled with some really bad luck, because one day after he leaves the ship, a massive squall blows in, and he and the five members that he's taken and the dogs are stranded on a small island just off of the Alaskan northern shore. And then the Karluk begins to move at breakneck speed toward the middle of the Arctic Ocean. And so one will never know what would have happened had he not become separated from the ship. But that the differences in their leadership, to me, begin at that moment, because in what they do from then, because Stephenson doesn't do much to find out what happens to the Karluk. And at that point, Captain Bartlett is now the default expedition leader, and has the lives of 25 people or two dozen people in his hands. And it's what he does versus what Stephenson does in the ensuing months that really characterize their different approaches to leadership. And I think to you could make the case, it's not so simple that Bartlett is a hero and Stephenson is a villain, but it is the case that Stephenson's decisions after that, I find very hard to square with, what an expedition leader should do to try to find out what happened to his flagship and the people on board. Right. And a kind of cavalier attitude with which he approaches. He basically re-outfits a new party and continues on doing exploration. And Bartlett is left to try to save all these lives.
Right, exactly. And that is really an indefensible attitude. And the story of Bartlett's heroism is really at the heart and soul of this story. We should mention that it's only a third of the way through the book that ultimately the Karluk is crushed by the ice and actually sinks. And those scrambling off of her just in time, and you describe the remarkable scene of Captain Bartlett as the destruction is nearing, playing one phonograph record after another on his gramophone in his quarters, and then throwing each of those records into the fire after he has played it, and putting on at the very end Chopin's Funeral March, and that is playing on his gramophone as he scurries to safety, and the Karluk vanishes. And from there, we still have two-thirds of the book as we follow the exploits of Captain Bartlett doing all he can to save as many of his crew and scientists and so on as possible. It is a remarkable story absolutely brilliantly in your book. And your book also tells us of who survives and of the ways in which the scars of this harrowing ordeal remain for the rest of their lives. The book, Empire of Ice and Stone, The Disastrous and Heroic Voyage of the Karluk, published by St. Martin's Press of New York, a book which includes, by the way, some very interesting photographs that also help to bring to life this amazing story. The author, Buddy Levy. Buddy Levy, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to help explore this story still further. Thank you so much and best wishes.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
And I add as a brief postscript to our interview this line from the review of the book in the New York Times, which said that this story is a testament to the idiotic optimism with which white men first blundered across the Arctic. Again, Buddy Levy's wonderful book is called Empire of Ice and Stone. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we commemorate a very special anniversary. It was 50 years ago this week that two members of the crew of Apollo 17 walked on the surface of the moon. It is the last time to date that human beings have been to the moon. Commemorating that, a spectacular new book called Apollo Remastered, The Ultimate Photographic Guide. I speak with Andy Saunders, who carefully examined over 30,000 images from the frozen